Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Jean-Guy Carrier, Secretary General, the International Chamber of Commerce. Jean-Guy, you have this remarkable background. You've done so much. You're a global figure. You're making historical contributions. Thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Pleasure.
Now, Jean-Guy, from the viewpoint of the ICC, what are the key measures for country success in terms of ICT's use in economic growth and social development?
Well, I think, you know, obviously in working with the IT sphere and in particular its manifestations in telecommunications and internet uses and so forth, to have an open market and an open attitude is the first prerequisite. And we've seen that operate you know, miracles in some parts of the world where the growth of the use of IT, the use of mobile telephone and other kinds of communication technologies has grown exponentially. And look at Africa in particular over the last 10 years. It's been a phenomenal impact it's had in that region. And because, again, the governments involved opened up, first of all, that you saw a progressive opening of capacity, first of all, but also opening to different suppliers being able to provide the vehicles for communications, and the population just, in fact, hungering for access to these things, taking it up massively. And you've seen the consequences of that in terms of job creation, in terms of economic growth. I mean, it's been a no small contribution to the fact that Africa is now, you know, ranked one of the fastest growing regions in the world. This is a historic first. And certainly IT and communications of one kind or another have played a crucial role in that. So in terms of the factors that we look at, I think that an open mind and an open market and a government which has that sort of openness is essential. Then, of course, you need the legal and regulatory environment that promotes investments, because these things cost money. The money usually has to come from outside, and not only from national sources, but international sources. And so some certainty about investment is necessary. There has to be, again, a possibility of open markets and therefore competition, which, of course, affects prices. I remember when we were first working with African countries some 15 years ago, just to give people internet access in government ministries, and where, in fact, it was completely unfeasible because you would have to pay something like $1,000 to simply get a hookup for a modest sort of access to the internet. And $1,000 at that time was almost insurmountable as an obstacle. The costs have gone down phenomenally because precisely there has been competition in those markets. I've been using Africa as an example, but it really is just one that stands out among many regions of the world where there has been this kind of explosive growth of communications and use of communications technologies. There has to be some sense also, again, of fostering innovation. I mean, the number of technical graduates in developing areas of the world, for instance, has again exploded exponentially because it became a good source of employment. You had a lot of very smart young men and women who suddenly saw this as a viable career path, and to be able to enable that and to build that into curricula in schools and universities is another important aspect of what's necessary. And I think the deployment of services based on, it's very nice. We used to talk about how we'd go and help people to connect in developing parts of the world, whether it was Latin America or parts of Asia and so forth. And the obvious question was, but for what? What are they going to connect to? And if all they're connecting to is game shows or one kind of amusement after another that's based on servers in North America or Europe or some other parts of the world than the one they inhabit, it isn't all that compelling. And so I think developing the kinds of applications which have emerged over the years in various languages and also very practical applications in for instance, in e-health and online education, this sort of thing has truly created not only a prospect of entertaining people, but of educating them, of helping them to get ahead, and therefore contributed significantly to the development of countries, of global economies.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about all of the kinds of changes that ICT has had, and I know there's this ITU figure about, you know, every 10% increase in broadband penetration produces a 1.3% gain in economic growth, or from the IT Innovation Foundation, there's a sort of figure that, you know, an investment in ICT will produce a 5 times total per factor productivity gain, or every dollar invested returning $5 in value. So it's playing a tremendous role, and you're talking about that. So let's explore that sort of even further. You know, what is the correlation between internet and ICT and economic growth, and how does a professionalized ICT workforce play a part?
Well, I think first of all, the connection, you know, is it can be everything from access to banking services through mobile telephones, which has had a really strong impact in parts of rural China. Parts of rural China, you know, we're talking about hundreds of millions of people who haven't had access to financial services ever, who suddenly are able to do some simple transactions, open accounts, and so forth. And conduct small businesses or just their routine activities through a banking system which is virtual. And you see it in all kinds of developments of this sort, where people, for instance, economies which are still very much based on agricultural production, you know, people used to have to guess which market to go to sell their cassavas or whatever they were producing, because they didn't know what market rates were available in what places. And now you've got a thriving system of commodity price information and market price information at a very small scale as well as a very high scale. So, you know, it begins with that, because that's what develops a true economy in many countries. And then it spreads to some very elaborate and sophisticated applications. As I was saying, for instance, the banking industry in various parts of the world and working with mobile telephony and so forth have created financial services, they've created health education services, they've created health delivery information through doctors being able to actually talk to patients at a distance and recommend treatments and so forth. Keeping in mind that I've been around for a while, I can remember a time when I was using what was then called the Internet, which was the original ARPANET back in the late 80s and 90s, that basically, you know, this was a very handy way for essentially scientists, academics, to exchange information, and it was really a form of email, if you want, and an exchange of basic documents. And it seemed miraculous at that time. And what I've been privileged to see over the subsequent couple of decades is that this early sort of conception of the ARPANET, which became the Internet, which then graduated to be the World Wide Web with Mosaic and other browsers coming on, has spread around the world. And part of the spread has been to introduce more and more technology that goes beyond the Internet, to mobile telephony and so forth. But basically, you know, there's been an IT phenomenon that has grown, and everywhere in the world, but I would say with a profound impact, principally in areas of the world that were least developed 20 years ago, and that we are now seeing rise as emerging forces in the world economy, simply because they have been able to organize themselves much more effectively than they have in the past. And part of that organization, that structure, is the communication possibilities that are offered by IT. It's really been one of the driving forces. I mean, you used to have to pay $1,000 U.S. To have a connection to the Internet, to a fairly bad connection to an Internet server through a local monopoly in most countries some years ago. $1,000 was more than many people made in a year. So, of course, you can see there was a tremendous gap. Along with the spread of the technologies, the mobile phone and the Internet use and so forth, has been also an increase in competitiveness in markets, which has really driven the prices down. And I would say, you know, along with this, we have to look at the situation historically where humankind has seen the greatest progress in terms of individuals rising out of poverty that there has been in any period in history. I mean, it's accounted over the last 20 years, really hundreds of millions of people have risen out of subsistence existences, out of basically very difficult circumstances, into what might be considered, you know, the beginning of a decent standard of living. And part of that has simply been the introduction of internet technologies, of telecommunications technologies, of technologies in general, to help them make that step through communication. And in terms of the impact at the upper end, if you want, it's clear that that IT technologies have grown in a way that has created tremendous numbers of opportunities, first of all, for young people around the world to first of all, be employed as IT technicians, as engineers, and so forth. And this has been a significant factor in reversing the brain drain from many regions of the world that was a predominant factor some years ago, where intelligent young people who managed to get some education couldn't find a job and went somewhere else, some other continent, some other part of the world. And so increasingly, I think that there's a very capable, solid IT structure that's been put in place by professionals from national economies who are employed and enthusiastic and are developing the capacity of countries that didn't have any 20 years ago. So that's been, you know, from the lowest scale where individuals are able to get information about where you sell your agricultural produce today for the best market, for the best price rather, in which city in any particular country, to in fact creating high-end employment opportunities for bright young people in these countries to be able to stay in their country and be productive and useful and constructive. This has been a very significant revolution, and a great deal of it has been fostered and driven by IT.
You know, I know, Jean-Guy, sometimes I see this figure that ICT development accounts for something like over 20% GDP growth and now in some countries, and I guess that's sort of an illustration of what's happening worldwide. And then earlier you talked about Africa and just the remarkable achievements that have been occurring in that country, and how the economies are growing so quickly. And really now Africa, sort of the future, and the world is looking at that for tremendous economic opportunities for other countries as well in terms of investments. And you also, you know, alluded to China and how the opening financial markets and how the internet growth there, you know, just a few years ago, I mean, the past decade, they had, you know, maybe 100 million, 200 million internet users. Now they're getting close to 600 million internet users. And it's just amazing, all of this sort of proliferation. Or the CIS regions of the world, where I think they have something like, 170% mobile penetration because of the overlap. Just amazing what's happening. Now, this next question, again, speaks to, again, you know, the insights that you have as this global leader, and that is, what is the importance of the role of the internet in terms of how it plays in job creation and social development?
Well, in terms of job creation, it's been, again, a key to developing an IT sector in many countries where there wasn't one. I mean, it was basically, if we look back 25 years ago, telephone systems, for instance, were the limit of what you did with IT, and they were all monopolies. And it was usually run by the National Postal Service or something similar to that. It was extremely inefficient because everything was based on landlines. You had also costs which were just unaffordable for the vast majority of people, and I'd say by the vast majority of small and medium-sized companies. I mean, you know, the growth of small and medium-sized companies around the world has been something that is has been also phenomenal. And a good part of it has been driven by the fact that suddenly individuals who start small and medium-sized companies, whether it's in the IT field or any field, providing services of one kind or another, suddenly have these, you know, what are nearly miraculous tools, if you consider the handicaps of the past, for being able to connect with customers and be able to deliver services to customers and build on the information they're able to harvest from the internet and from other sources. So it's had a pervasive influence on economies. And you know, we can pull out numbers about job growth in IT, but in other areas. But it really is pervasive. I mean, it's everything from, you know, agricultural employment that's been affected by access to these technologies. I mean, you've got solar-powered mobile telephone stations in some of the poorest parts of the world that used to be cut off completely from the rest of the world, where individuals now are able to communicate with others within their country, but also in other regions. And often these are small business people. I would say even, you know, what we had a few years ago was an amazing phenomenon where you would go to a lot of markets, community markets in Latin America or in Africa, in some of the poorest countries, and you'd see people who had a business basically leasing their mobile phone to individuals who were getting useful information or making contact with relatives through these means. So it's been pervasive in that sense. And then I would say it's also created in many countries something which is now, you know, across all of our economies, a professional class of individuals which simply wasn't there in the past. And it's everybody that's involved in IT. And that can be anything from a technician who is using new technologies in a hospital setting or a clinic in a remote area to one kind of another of technician, engineer, and so forth. And as I said, in small businesses that are largely sometimes based on the information and the capacities that are provided by IT. So it's been pervasive, and as I was saying, it's one of those things, the fact that we've had this emerging force of people that used to be cut off from the world economy over the last 20 years, I mean hundreds of millions of people, is in part due to the existence of the technological means that they, you know, have been able to help them rise out of poverty and be, you know, contributors to their national economy and part of the global economy as well.
It's interesting. I see this recent CNN report where they talk about the increasing rise of freelancing in the West. In other words, people not working for a typical corporation anymore. They just freelance their skills and they work on different projects. And it could be during the course of a year, they could work for five different companies, but they don't belong to any one company anymore. So, you know, I chair this thing called the Global Industry Council, and Kishore Swaminathan, who's the chief scientist or was the chief scientist for Accenture, talked about this. He said, corporate boundaries are going to disappear. Country boundaries are going to disappear. All work is going to be project-based because of the enablement of the Internet. And you talk about the rise of small business and around the world. Really, any individual can be a business because of the Internet. The cost of selling wares or services is just so inexpensive today. And so it's quite exciting. And the thing is you're a big part of that because of the role that you play. So the next question is, what is the power of the multi-stakeholder approach to issues that lead to informed policy decisions?
Well, what you've just said, of course, resonates to most of us who've been following this closely on the ground in terms of its development over the last decades. But it also is clear that this wonderful freedom to have access to technologies, to use technologies, to access information, to share information, to develop markets on a smaller or larger scale, all of that is always in peril, if you want, by the fact that there is increasing amount of regulation. I mean, this is normal. When the Internet started, when the mobile telephony was beginning, et cetera, the limits were technological. What's happening now is, as you've got, you know, as you say, 600 million internet users in China and billions of internet users around the world, is there is an increasing need to put some order in that potential chaos. And I think, you know, that's something that is normal. It will happen, and it is happening. But our concern is always that maintaining a reasonable amount of freedom and public participation in shaping the policies that result in regulation for information technologies is a crucial part of maintaining the dynamism of those media and to maintaining as well, you know, their capacity to continue to transform our societies for the better. And there is, you know, there is necessarily in a phenomenon which liberates an awful lot of energy and creativeness from individuals, there are going to be parts of our societies which feel threatened. And so I think, again, when there is a possibility of an open debate about how do we regulate different parts of the activity, I mean, there are there's cybercrime. It's a reality. There are all kinds of things which, pornography and all the rest of that, which, you know, which are aspects of information technologies which need to be addressed. You can't just have kind of a freewheeling Wild West all the time, forever. And our feeling is simply that the experience of the last decades, in working out these regulatory approaches in some multi-stakeholder form, in the sense that where you have governments and NGOs and business organizations like ours and so forth engaged in the process of discussing and deciding and what is the best way to regulate, has been extremely successful. You know, it hasn't stymied the creativity and the potential of the information technologies, but it has permitted sort of a gradual sort of control where there was a need to put one. And so, you know, our conviction is very much based on practice. We believe that the multi-stakeholder approach to regulating technologies has demonstrated its capacity to do the job properly. We have seen, I think, all of us, over the last decades, also examples where you get heavy-handed governments who decide that they know best and they impose limits on the use of telephones and mobile telephony in general and internet use and so forth. And certainly in contrast to a multi-stakeholder approach, a free approach where there's an engagement of different parts of society, world society, in discussing and developing means of regulation, the heavy-handed approach is a fairly deadening one. You know, it in fact runs counter to the creative drive that is inherent in new technologies.
Your discussion of this multi-stakeholder approach, there's this sort of tension, I guess, between ICON and sort of the ITU and what's occurring within some of the countries that are members of the ITU, and opposed to maybe some of the Western countries that are part of the ITU, or Vintcerf, I guess. I saw this CNN iReport where Vintcerf sort of came out in terms of, I guess, a multi-stakeholder approach, and then I saw sort of some of the counter arguments from representing, you know, maybe not so much of a broader approach. It's a controversial area, but it sounds like you're more in favor of this open policy.
Well, I think it's, you know, what we are engaged in is we now have a global phenomenon in IT. And it's not just the internet, it's communications across the board. And it is, you know, it is not little segments and friends here and there. I mean, you've got people at all kinds of cultures, all kinds of countries, all kinds of occupations who are using and dependent on the use of information technologies. And so there is we go very much along the reasoning that there is a need to determine some rules, like there is for most kinds of trade across borders. Telecommunications is a kind of way of exchanging data and exchanging information and so forth. And putting in place some regulations which help do that is sensible. There are also cultural considerations that one can't ignore. I mean, in some parts of the world, showing some kinds of content is more effective, more offensive, rather, than in other parts of the world. And so the wish to be able to control that content to some extent is a natural outcome of the freeing, if you want, of communications that's happened. Our approach is simply that, you know, we recognize the need to improve, to develop rules and to have some regulatory means of conditioning, if you want, the content and the flow of information, but that the best way to do it is if all the players, if all of those who have a stake in those technologies get to say their word and get to basically discuss the options to arrive at some sort of consensus on what can be done in terms of rules and regulations. And again, our experience is that it works, you know, that whether it's through the ITU or other means, you know, there have been progressively the agreements on putting into place some rules and regulations and so forth, which create more structure in IT usage, that is certainly preferable to us, that multi-stakeholder approach where you get different components of society, of NGOs and government and business organizations and suppliers and users and so forth, having a say in the discussion, in the debate that leads to rules that are agreed to is much better than to decree, to have any national government or international body decree, for its own reasons, what those rules and regulations should be. We think that that kind of approach would run counter, really, to the creative force, which is at the heart of information technology, where the more people are involved, the more thinking there is for more individuals. We've seen that that is a very it's a means that's very conducive to positive development of new services, of new improved technologies, and so forth. So we're very not only convinced, but we believe that the experience of the last couple of decades demonstrates that a multi-stakeholder approach, in fact, works and remains the best way to go about creating rules and regulations to govern IT usage, including the Internet.
Jean-Guy, it's clear that you want to safeguard an inclusive approach to the management of the Internet. Here's a related question, though. How is the free flow of information a bedrock for freedom of expression and cross-border trade and sharing of knowledge?
Well, I think that the... It's I think part of what's happened in terms of economic growth in the world has come from a better distribution, if you want, of knowledge, of information. There's the old conundrum about are poor people poor because of ignorance, or are they ignorant because they're poor? I think that we've seen a demonstration that use of information technologies has diminished ignorance among people and increased prosperity amongst those people. And so that's kind of a basic illustration of the fact that that sharing information, that sharing technologies, that sharing knowledge is conducive to improving the standard of living of people around the world. And to us, anyways, I think that it's also created opportunities for small and medium-sized businesses around the world to be able to generate employment and to be able to therefore contribute to improving the standard of living and educational possibilities in regions around the globe. I think what we are seeing, on the other hand, is this is a new world. 20 years ago, the Internet was basically a potential. And what we have right now is an explosion and a kind of fascination and a concentration on the social aspects of sharing information, and, trivial or important information, right around the world. And you can see that, there's got to be a further evolution. It's not just always going to be an expansion of, we just have more Facebooks and we have more of this and that sort of search engine and this and that sort of public forum. That we're getting into, a space where there's increasingly specialized use of information technologies for specific purposes, whether it's education or health or simply communications. And all of that does call on all of us to have some wisdom in terms of being able to channel a lot of the data and information. I think the corollary, is that, and we're seeing it now with the furore over basically intelligence agencies in different countries making extremely creative use of information technologies to harvest data, as they say. This is a new term. Suddenly there are, sort of quantum amounts of data which are available, and with governments who have the capacity technologically to harvest that data. And this, again, sort of is something which is new. It didn't exist 20 years ago. You would have traditional spying going on between nations and between companies, possibly, and so forth. But here now you have sort of entire new industries that have risen up basically on the fact that there's so much information out there and so many people sharing it that you can, in fact, harvest it and do with it whatever you wish. This is something to worry about. This is sort of a downside of the IT revolution that we are all experiencing. which has tremendous amounts of benefits, but also that requires at some stage that we all give some thought to, you know, where we're going with this. And I think it's not simply a mindless expansion of what we have, but, you know, about using, in some cases, the internet technologies and information technologies more wisely, investing in them more constructively than has been the case in the past. And you can see this, you know, even within large internet companies, internet-based companies, that there's the beginning of a thought, you know, that maybe there's also a social purpose to this, as well as a commercial purpose, as well as a social purpose that goes beyond simply exchanging personal data or personal information or gossip or whatever else. That there is this is having an impact on all our societies, and there's a need to consider what it means and in fact how it should evolve. This is where we come back to a multi-stakeholder approach, where certainly from our perspective as a business organization, we don't think the appropriate solution is to have an international agency that decides for everybody how things are going to evolve, or any small collection of national economies that decides for everybody how things are going to evolve. We think that, again, the only way to do it intelligently and in a way that safeguards the strength of internet technologies is through an approach that brings in as many points of view as possible, that involves a public debate, a transparent debate about what we want to do with these technologies, where we want them to go, and that leads to some consensus, you know, some direction and some rules and regulations which help us get where we want to be with these kinds of technologies.
Zhang-Gi, it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of idea of this whole quantum leap and the amount of information that's available that can be mined. And I guess it then speaks to sort of security issues, privacy issues, and so on. And then earlier you talked about cybercrime and sort of the increasing risk of cybercrime and what that means. Do you see maybe a code of ethics applied to a professionalized ICT workforce as a means of helping to, you know, limit some of those kind of abuses that could occur?
I think it's inevitable. You know, when we're talking about a virtual world, it's nonetheless a human-created world. And so in any society that's been created by humans anywhere in the world, you get the full panoply of good and evil. You know, you get crime, and you get charitable impulses, and you get, you know, social sort of interaction and so forth. Everything is there. And that's what is emerged in the virtual world. It's not surprising. This, you know, human beings have created it, and therefore the various facets of our personality, of our character, is impregnated in the digital world, in the virtual world. And I think what we have had as a notion is that it's either going to continue to expand without any fetters, without any control, or it's going to have to be thought about in terms of limiting the worst aspects, whether it's cybercrime, whether it's exposing young children to things they shouldn't be exposed to, et cetera, or all kinds of nefarious activities. It's something that I think you can't just say we're not concerned about that, or we shouldn't deal with it because it calls too many things into question. I think that certainly people in the industry are beginning very seriously to understand that even service providers, that what they have is not just a business, that there is a very strong social component to what they are doing in terms of an activity and what they're enabling people to do in terms of exchanging information. And, you know, there is a real wish for the development of some rules. And I think that people in the IT profession in particular are not necessarily the best ones to arrive at these rules, but they certainly are the ones who I think have the greatest level of expectation that, you know, if something is going wrong with the digital world that society agrees is not a right thing, is not a correct thing, then, you know, tell us what we need to do about it. Tell us how we can control it. And let's agree on those rules that would enable us to, in fact, keep those negative aspects of human nature to a limit in terms of the virtual world.
It's interesting, you know, sort of this idea of having some kind of, I don't know, rules or policies within corporations, maybe even broader than that, and maybe through a code of ethics. Something I saw recently, and in fact I did an interview on it, was some universities, and it's kind of spreading around the world, when their students graduate, they get them to sign something called the pledge, And the pledge is about really behaving in a responsible, professional manner and adhering to and promising to adhere to things like ethical conduct and so on. So it speaks to everything that you're talking about. And it's good to see some of these kinds of outreach initiatives occurring, I guess because of this sort of social media aspect that's enabled by the internet. My next question is about, you know, you are this person who has risen globally and is making enormous strides and is well known for your work at the WTO and earlier some of your work in communications and so on. Now you are the Secretary General of this, an amazing organization, the ICC, the International Chamber of Commerce. What is the mandate behind the ICC?
Well, the mandate of the ICC, which was created in 1919, you know, has based on the principle that open borders, that open markets, that trade and investment between countries is one of the best ways to foster peace and prosperity in the world. The founders of the organization, you know, were just coming out of the First World War, which was a calamitous event for a good part of humanity. And so they were driven by this notion that, you know, countries that are open to each other, where there is exchange across borders of not only goods and services, but ideas, tend to contribute to each other's development and therefore are less likely to fall into conflicts with each other. I mean, of course, we've seen, it's not absolute, but you know, but I think that that is still the principle that we adhere to as an organization, and that are the business people who make up the organization, and there's something like over 6 million small and medium-sized companies around the world who are part of the ICC network, as well as some big companies. You know, that basically that's the kind of spirit we try to inculcate in everybody, that that openness is good for humankind, for human development and advancement. And whether it's in trade or in ideas, that it's something to be safeguarded. At the same time, recognizing that, you know, for instance, on trade, I mean, you've got over the years what's facilitated this philosophy or this spirit of openness is to create some rules. And so you have, for instance, in the early GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and then in the World Trade Organization, its successor, you know, thousands and thousands of agreements and rules between countries on how we will do, what we will do in terms of trade and what we will not do. It's a bad practice and that hurts others. And so, you know, this is the sort of thing that it took 60 years to work out. but it is now in place, and it's a good example of the fact that, the best way to encourage openness is to agree on what the rules of that openness are going to be, to have the best possible adherence to it. And I'd say, you know, beyond what you were saying in terms of people signing a pledge, that's very good. You know, the Ten Commandments have been around for some millennia. It's always necessary in any human activity to also have some means of enforcing. And so you can count on the goodwill and compassion of individuals, but it often isn't sufficient. In dealing with cybercrime, in dealing with intrusions of one kind or another into people's personal lives, into personal information and so forth, there will be a need for some means of enforcement. And that, I think, is, again, something that we as a business organization believe that in other areas like trade and investment has been developed cooperatively, you know, through a multi-stakeholder approach in the sense that governments have negotiated, they've brought in NGOs, they've brought in business to have their say, and then they've agreed rules and they put them in place, including some mechanisms for being able to force perspective those rules. And I think that is the way we're going with the internet, and that's certainly the path that we as an organization are advocating, that there be that kind of consensual approach to developing rules and even some means of enforcing those rules.
Sean Gee, you're the Secretary General of this organization, and because of your history, in fact, a remarkable history of success, you've taken on this mantle as Secretary General of the ICC. And it's going to have an historical sort of impact or reverberations. And in essence, you're going to, in some ways, influence the planet today and for the future. So what is your mandate as Secretary General for this year and for the future?
Well, I think we're talking about information technologies in particular. It is certainly to work with business people around the world who are very much at the heart of development in this field, to ensure that there's an open and fair development of technologies, that there is some concern for in improving competitiveness in various markets, for improving inclusiveness in various markets. So that again, I think that this boon to humankind, which is represented by information technologies, really a new phenomenon that is completely new in human history, that it gets used to best effect. And that really is, frankly, my mandate in terms of information technologies and working with other international organizations, working with government, working with businesses, is to ensure that we, in fact, make progress and don't slip back in terms of individual rights to be able to access and use these technologies, you know, for the betterment of individual lives and our societies.
Again, speaking from your very unique position as Secretary General, what do you see as the opportunities for national economies?
Well, I think in terms of national economies, there still are a tremendous number of economies that are just emerging. And certainly all of us are working with national governments to bring more and more countries, and therefore more national communities, if you want, into the fold of the world community. This is an ongoing struggle. I mean, it's not as if that because we in some parts of the world, in Europe, North America, and other parts, have a fairly freewheeling access to information, to education, to various services delivered through the internet and otherwise. Just because it exists to a high level in some areas doesn't mean that there still isn't a tremendous amount of work to do to bring other parts of the world community on board. And I think, you know, I tend to believe, and I think my organization shares the belief that what's good for some individuals should be shared with everybody who can make use of it, and that is the best way of creating a world which has some fairness to it and which has some stability to it as well, in terms of avoiding conflict. Because, you know, again, when we're looking at the positive side of all this, there are significant downsides. You can see that part of what's happening in the cyber world is a kind of segmentation. Some of it by culture, some of it by language. And, you know, it's not necessarily a sort of an interwoven web, worldwide web, anymore. It is becoming, in fact, cloistered in some respects and so forth. And, again, trying to avoid the closing of minds and the closing of borders, in this case digital borders, that has been one of the problems of human society in the past, is certainly part of the work that we as an organization are trying to achieve, working again with governments, working with other international organizations, but to make sure that the various paths that we are on, which are very promising and are developing benefits for humankind, continue to do that, rather than becoming narrower and more coercive and possibly more dangerous for all of us.
Earlier, Jean-Guy, you talked about the very direct connection between investment in ICT and national economies, and also in businesses, and in enabling people to prosper. So what policies need to be implemented to foster innovation, which is very closely tied in with ICT?
Yes, well, I think that, you know, it's a complicated question, and the answer is indistinct in some respects. I will give you my answer as best I can. The thing is that there's, you know, we all would rally to the notion that that sharing knowledge, sharing technologies, capacity, and so forth, is a good thing. But you know, there are boundaries of intellectual property, there are boundaries of competitiveness, and so forth, which already are realities of life. And I think what we can see is that in terms of enabling investment in technology, especially in emerging and developing parts of the world, having, again, a climate in place, a regime in place where there are clear rules and laws, etc., protecting investment, is a requirement. I mean, you simply don't get investment. For instance, you've had a country like Myanmar, which for 50 years has been literally cut off from the rest of the world. You know, 80% of people in Myanmar still don't have access to electricity. I mean, this is a pretty dire situation. And now you see with the gradual opening of that country under a new government, under the inspiration of leaders like Aung San Suu Kyi and so forth, that you suddenly have, you know, investors looking at that country as a prospect. You know, looking at that country not as a dark hole, where you wouldn't put your money because, my goodness, what's going to happen to it? You know, you're looking at opportunity as opposed to a disaster. And it's just an illustration, really, of what we're talking about, that if you create a climate of confidence, of rules and regulations and laws that, you know, give some assurance to investors, this can be at the very small scale. It can be in terms of investing simply in a manufacturing capacity, a manufacturing facility in a country, or it can be in setting up telecommunication systems or investing in those systems or investing in social programs. It can be all kinds of things. But if you don't have confidence at the heart of an economy, a national economy, then you're not going to get investors coming in. And you can talk about exchanging information for all you want, but if the money isn't there to enable it to grow to scale, to be able to be developed, because the investors are query about a particular region, then it's just not going to happen. So I think that's, you know, we keep talking about a world economy, which is in expansion, but, you know, and that world economy, frankly, doesn't work on money. There's all kinds of currencies in the world. It works on confidence. And if you want to have investment in IT as much as in any other area, there has to be an ambiance, a spirit of confidence that investment, in fact, is going to develop some returns, going to develop some good results for the population involved, but also a good return for the investors. And if you don't have that, you simply don't get the investment. You can talk to me blue in the face about the wonders of technology, but it's not going to happen. So I think, again, my example with Myanmar, you know, over the last 50 years, people have wanted to have mobile phones as much as anybody else in the world, but no one was going to invest any money to create that situation because the government wasn't open to it. Now they are, and they are putting in together. You know, they've just passed a new investment law a few months ago, which has reassured a tremendous number of investors. And so you're going to see a very rapid development in that country, just as an example, that is similar to what's happened in many other regions of the world. Because, again, there is a system of law, a system of respect for the rule of law and regulations and some confidence that you can make investments safely and productively in that country.
You know, it's interesting your sort of take on that question about innovation, you know, sort of policies to foster innovation. You talked about making sure that you can create confidence so that there will be investment. And I guess that triggers in my mind this kind of idea, like, for example, Obama's U.S. Jobs Act, the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act, which is about or supports crowdfunding. Or regulated crowdfunding, or you have companies like Kickstarter, which allow anybody to kind of submit a project and get funding for it from just people out there, you know, sort of the millions that are out there who are willing to say, hey, I'll put in $10 or $100 or something like that. But there's no exchange of equity. It's just sort of, you know, they'll maybe get in line for the first products or they get some sort of recognition. So this rising sort of trend towards, you know, getting funding from just anybody out there, this crowdfunding idea or microfinancing. What are your views on that?
Well, I think that the microfinancing is a phenomenon which has, again, shown itself to be very effective. That small amounts of money invested by ordinary individuals in you know, advancing their own activities, their personal activities, and very small business activities sometimes, you know, buying an additional number of cattle or buying an additional number of chickens so you can produce eggs and go to the market and sell those eggs, etc., you know, which is made possible by being able to borrow $20 or $100, small amounts of money. I mean, is again, multiplied millions of times, had a tremendous impact on a lot of people's lives. So I think the idea that that there should be different sources of capital available for investment is fairly common. You know, it's not the lack of money that's at the heart of anybody's problem. Sometimes it is simply that even if you can get the money in many regions of the world, it's extremely difficult to start a business. You know, a virtual business, a real business, a stall somewhere, any kind of business. Sometimes it is simply discouraging the number of hoops you have to jump through, the kinds of, you know, ridiculous kinds of regulations, bureaucratic red tape regulations that governments put in the way of people trying to create a business. You know, and this is not a developing country phenomenon exclusively. In fact, in many developing countries now, you can start a business within 48 hours. You know, you can get your permit, you can get your whatever you need to have official sort of recognition that you're a business and you can be in business and start selling a service or a product. In many developed economies, I must say, it still takes sometimes months to set up a company. And therefore is very discouraging to a lot of people. So we can talk about access to financing. There's easier access to financing in many parts of the world than there is access to simply the permission, the bureaucratic, official, governmental permission that says you can now start a business. And you can sell things on the internet, you can sell things through a store or whatever you're proposing to do. That is the real problem, you know, is that the technology has evolved faster than human societies, especially some governments' capacities to absorb it and to adapt to it. So there's still a lot of that kind of red tape and bureaucracy that gets in the way and stands between people who need investment to start a business and the investors who are quite happy to provide it, you know, whether they're small amounts or big amounts. Standing between them often is a very difficult barrier of government regulations, which are outdated, which are from the past, and don't really fit in the modern world, but are still there.
Chongyi, it's always interesting. Every time you provide an answer, it kind of triggers some sort of ideas in terms of my thinking. It just reminds me of I was at the ITU WISIS forum in Geneva in May, and then last year the same, and then I spoke at the economic forum in Astana, but what struck me was this country, Kazakhstan, that they have this e-government system, e-participation, which they won, I guess they were ranked second in the world, tied with Singapore last year. And then this year at the ITU WISIS Forum, they got the e-business, e-government award for sort of being the top in innovation. And you talked about this idea that even in Western countries, it could take weeks, perhaps, to register a business. They've developed a system where you can register and start a business within, I think it's about 10 to 15 minutes. So, I guess it speaks to developing countries
in some
are not.
Countries like France, in some countries like France, it still takes weeks. what is even more retrograde in my mind is that there still is a public debate about, you know, whether this is a good thing or not. You know, it's as if you're suspicious of giving people the green light to go ahead and start a business, create some jobs, some economic activity. I mean, as if this is somehow, you know, maybe there's a question as to the usefulness of this in society.
Yeah, or this study that was done in the U.S. that, what is it now, over the last 3 decades, most of all net new jobs are created by small business. So people should do anything they can to support small business, right?
Well, listen, I think that's, you know, uncontested. I mean, any reference you use from figures from the World Bank, from the IMF, from any organization, the OECD and so forth, you know, constantly reconfirms that the world economy is driven really by small and medium-sized companies. We all, you know, are familiar with multinationals, the Nestles of the world and the Shells and so forth, but the vast majority of jobs. And I'd say, you know, even in international trade, some over 80% of international trade is done by small and medium-sized companies, you know, and who basically are the drivers of cross-border trade around the world. And so enabling, I mean, it would seem to be terribly sensible for any government to say, we want to make it as easy as possible. Now, of course, we want to prevent, you know, fraudsters and others from sort of starting businesses, which, you know, dupe people and steal their money and so forth. But we have to have some process where we, you know, we are able to formalize, you know, our permission to start a business. But making it as simple as possible would seem to be a logical thing to do, and it's just still not the case in many parts of the world. And it really is one of the impediments, really, dealing with, for instance, the crisis we're living through now. You've got unemployment rates in some countries that are, you know, among youth over 30%, which is a horrible phenomenon. And again, governments don't have the means to create the employment that's needed to give those people some purpose, some means of making a living. And there still is, in many of those countries, there's still a very complicated way of creating a business. You know, that makes it almost discouraging for anybody, a young person who wants to start a business. That is something that, you know, that could be fixed. It could be fixed very quickly. And certainly it's something that we are working with governments to try and make sure is improved over a shorter time as possible.
Now, we're down to our last two questions, and this next question is about areas of controversy, and you are so well-traveled. You are this luminary, recognized globally. You have this remarkable background of accomplishment and contribution. Can you describe then some areas of controversy and the areas that you work?
Areas of controversy, yeah. My goodness. are you thinking about the IT field in particular, or just business in general?
You can make it as broad as you wish.
Well, you know, that one of the big problems when you were, I worked with a lot more people at all sort of walks of life, meeting with heads of government and heads of international organizations, but also on the ground with, you know, small business people and people who work in small businesses. And one of the conundrums of modern life for me and for our organization is that you've had this incredible expansion of wealth, if you want, and prosperity around the world, where truly, China 30 years ago was cut off from the world. Most people were living below the poverty line, you know, on small plots of land in the countryside. You suddenly got China, the second biggest economy in the world. But China's not the only source of that. I mean, you've seen all of that sort of growth in Africa, in Latin America. I mean, a few years ago, to talk about world economies did not include Turkey and Brazil and Argentina and, you know, a host of countries which are now important in the world economy. And one of the, so you've had this explosive growth and spread of prosperity, but the counter is that you've seen in all these countries, and you see it in the U.S., you see it in Europe, you see it in China, you see it in Brazil, there's been an incredible increase in inequality, you know, between the people who are earning the least and those who are making the most. And this is it's a cleavage, you know, a social cleavage that is a serious phenomenon. I mean, how did this happen? You know, how can you get this kind of explosive, phenomenal growth in China across the country and yet be seeing that, you know, that the poor people are getting poorer and rich are getting richer? This is, for us, it's a social problem. You know, it's not a political problem. It is a social problem that at some stage creates tensions which get in the way of all of us doing business. And it's something that is a concern. You know, it's controversial in the sense that it's very hard to raise these issues in any circle, but with governments, because they start feeling like someone's pointing a finger at them. But my goodness, you know, we've created all these jobs over the years, etc. We've raised all these people out of poverty. But then when you look at these numbers, and again, it's credible sources that are looking at this. It's, you know, it's international organizations, it's the World Bank, it's the OECD, who are saying, you know, there's a problem here. that you've got this rise and spread of prosperity, but it is badly distributed. And so it's creating social tension. It's creating the kinds of complexities which are going to rebound on all of us in very negative ways. And so for us, it's a concern. You know, it's controversial to deal with it, but we think it has to be, that certainly business people are concerned about it. You know, they're terribly concerned about it. So there's that side. I'd say the other controversy we have is that, in all of this furthered activity, commercial activity around the world, you've had people straying from basic human principles about probity and transparency and doing business in an honest way. And this can involve, you know, high-scale finance. It can involve all kinds of things. And we think that that's a problem as well. And it's something that in our membership, people are terribly concerned about. And we're talking about how did we get to this situation where, business is in fact taking advantage of circumstances sometimes to the detriment of the populations in their countries, whether it's banks or other kinds of institutions and so forth. So this is a big concern. You know, it is not just a controversy. It's something we believe that needs to be addressed, and that certainly business people are talking about and talking to government about. Now, how do we get back to some basic human principles about how you do business in an honest way, in a way that you know, gives you an honest return as a business, but also contributes to developing your society?
And now we're down to our last question, and that is from a global perspective. Can you summarize the greatest challenges facing business today and how they can be overcome?
Well, I think this last question that I was just raising for me and for our organization is a crucial one. I think that we've seen the rise of business as a worldwide phenomenon, as a driver of the world economy. And we've also seen situations where, the economic activity has gotten so widespread and so monumental in scale that you forget about the human aspect of what you're doing. And part of that is forgetting about, you know, proper rules and principles for behaving as a good human being. And therefore as a good company, the company that understands it has a social license to operate, that it needs to respect some ways of doing business which are not only good for itself but for its society. This is, I think, to us anyways, is one of the biggest challenges, because it is truly not just economic as an issue, it is social and moral. And you know, business is not accustomed to dealing with this. The bottom line is properly the business of business and, you know, getting a proper return. But we're finding that, in fact, in a world which is increasingly linked and complex, the moral question, the questions of having some principles, being civilized in your behavior, has come back onto the table as an important issue.
Well, Jean-Guy, you've very much explored many areas, and we're very appreciative, and considering your demanding schedule. Thank you for coming in today and sharing your deep experiences with the audience.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for some probing questions, and I hope that I've been able to give you some light on some of them.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Jean-Guy Carrier, Secretary General, International Chamber of Commerce, or ICC.